Help me welcome today's icing on the cake, Don M.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Don Major, and I'm an alcoholic. And I am truly grateful to be here this morning. You folks have just been so sweet to Sharon and me, and the fellowship of the Spirit is alive and well in North Carolina. Thank you so much. Beth has been just a delightful hostess, and Joanne and all of her folks that have helped her put this event together have just been grand. So thank you all. You've been wonderful. My wife Sharon and I have friends that have joined us this morning, and Beth and the committee were kind enough to let our friends Nell and Don, who live down in Rock Hill, South Carolina, join us. We met Don and Nell in Egypt on an Egyptian trip, and they won't come see what their friend Don was involved in. I think they may have thought it was kind of a cult or something, you know. And I have so enjoyed the speakers this weekend. Of course, Dave and Sandy and our sweet Al-Anon speaker, Pauline, and Teresa yesterday was absolutely wonderful. I did miss Thursday night, but, Dave and Sandy make me feel like a newcomer. I emailed a sponsee of mine last night that they made me feel like a newcomer, and that is a very good thing. It's a very good thing for me to feel like a newcomer because, my sobriety date's April 9th of 1981, and my home group is the Calm Down Group, right? I named that group 20 years ago when we started it, because it meets on Wednesdays, and by that time I normally need to calm down. And it's right across the river from downtown Louisville, Kentucky. And, there are a whole lot of advantages of me seeing myself as a newcomer. And one of them is this. After the years of sobriety and having traveled around the country somewhat and met a lot of folks and talked different places and sponsoring a bunch of folks, tell you what happens. When I get in trouble, the first thing that occurs to me is that I need to find some really complex, advanced spiritual solution. I need to talk to the gurus of the gurus, and we need to have some sort of epiphany that may be worthy of recording for posterity. Let me tell you, when I run into trouble in my sobriety today, I need to go to more meetings. I need to talk to my sponsor. I need to pray more. I need to quit thinking about my raggedy butt and start thinking what I can do for somebody else. I need to remember that nothing will so much ensure my immunity from taking a drink as working from another alcoholic. I need to do exactly the same things that I needed to do in April of 1981 when I got sober. So newcomer is really good for me. And I got some bad news this morning, some good news, folks. Bad news is we're going to need a lot of divine intervention over the next hour or 50 minutes if I manage to stay in it. The good news is I've found out as long as I'll stay close to you folks and these 12 steps that, as far as I know, are the only program of recovery we've got around here, that divine intervention is pretty doggone easy to get. But I found this out about divine intervention, too, and I just hate this. Don't get much divine intervention on Sunday based on what I did on Saturday. Have to base it on what I do today. My divine intervention is kind of like being rocketed into the fourth dimension, and Sandy was talking about that rocketed into the fourth dimension, and I, too, thought that was really, silly when I first read it, But I want to tell you, I have been in the fourth dimension of existence at least 5,000 times. Now, think about that a minute. That means I have fallen out of the fourth dimension of existence at least 4,999 times. And that's the way it always is with me. Is just keep on stumbling in the right direction. And that's the way it works. And I need divine intervention to get me out of the way. I can't get me out of the way. If I could get me out of the way, I could have stayed in Louisville and not come to Charlotte this weekend. I wouldn't need to go to meetings, wouldn't need any of it. But I'm not a bit more capable of getting me out of the way than I was in April 1981. And a place where we're really going to need divine intervention is I'm going to try to follow directions. Now, I've got a long and sad history with the directions. As some of you will realize, my case is different. Always has been, and the directions have never applied to me. And there's a little fellow inside me, and he and I are the world's greatest experts on everything. Always have been. Whether we know anything about it or not is totally irrelevant, you know. And not only are we so well informed, we are sophisticated and worldly. We know how the world really works. You don't pull wool over our eyes. And we know who makes the directions. Square Johns. Just absolute buttoned-down conservative Square Johns. And they're usually being advised by insurance lawyers who worse than they are. And we know who the directions are made for. Idiots. You know, just stone idiots. And, of course, the directions are always overstated to try to manipulate idiots into doing things. And, of course, in a special circumstance like mine, it's necessary to sort of extrapolate in order to figure out what the directions really mean. And I will assure you that if I haven't done the work I need to do today, the work that I need to do that is the maintenance of my spiritual condition, because thank God I do understand now my daily reprieve is not based on my spiritual condition. If it was, it'd be mighty scary, because some days I wake up and by my lights, my spiritual condition is not very good. My daily reprieve is based on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. And that's the work that I do. And that's the difference in day and night. That means regardless of how I wake up feeling, regardless of how cut off I may feel, regardless of how much I don't want to pray that morning, regardless of how much I don't want to do this and that, and regardless of how much it doesn't feel right, if I will do those actions, I'm going to get my daily reprieve. I'm absolutely going to get it. And I just lost my train of thought, and that's perfectly fine. But at any rate, on following those directions, I assure you that if I haven't done what I need to do to get my divine intervention, for instance, if I were to see something that said, do not exceed 6 in 24 hours, my brain will register that as really meaning something like do not exceed 36 in 24 hours. And the directions I hope to follow this morning are the simple ones. Talk a little bit about what I was like and what happened and what I'm like now. And there's another set of directions in the book that we don't talk about as much, but I really hope my story carries a message on it. And the book says that our story, personal story, is telling our own language and from our own point of view how we've been able to form a relationship with our Creator. And I really hope my story carries that, because when I was first exposed to Alcoholics Anonymous, I wasn't just closed to spiritual matters and the idea of God. I was allergic to it. And when you all would mention it, I swear the little hairs would stand up on the back of my neck. And my intelligence would be insulted. And as far as you all talking about higher power, you weren't kidding me. You were trying to backdoor me on that God crap. I think that made me even madder. So that kept running me out the door of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm one of the ones that's so blessed, because I kept getting run back in here by alcohol, because I didn't have anywhere else to go. Didn't know I didn't have anywhere else to go, but I didn't. Until finally the biggest miracle that's ever happened in my life, or I believe will ever happen in my life, happened. And I was given that first little bit of teachability or humility I'd ever had in my life. The first willingness to do some things that were suggested, even though I didn't understand them, I didn't agree with them, I didn't think they would work, and I certainly didn't want to do them. You guys had been holding your hand out to me for 2 or 3 years by the time I got sober. But sometime in April 1981, I was given the great gift of being able to take your hand and let you lead me through these 12 steps. And those steps led me to a loving God I didn't even know was there for me. And that miracle that I just described, that willingness that God gave me to take your hand and let you lead me through this, through these steps that are the program and let you bring me into this wonderful fellowship of the Spirit, that is the only reason on the face of this earth that I'm standing down here in front of you beautiful folks in Charlotte, North Carolina, instead of having been rotting in a pauper's grave for over 29 years. I was just a very few days from that pauper's grave when I got that wonderful, wonderful gift. I grew up on a tobacco farm in southwestern Kentucky. I know a lot of you folks in North Carolina know a little something about tobacco. And probably the most informative thing I can tell you about my childhood and early life is that it wasn't a thing like I thought it was. Just absolutely nothing. And Sandy touches on that in different language, but my capacity for self-delusion is absolutely astounding. And the amazing thing is that after 29 years without a drink, several thousand AA meetings and a few trips through the steps, if I haven't done the work I need to do today to maintain my spiritual condition and get my divine intervention, it's fully intact. I'm just as capable of self-delusion as I was in April 1981. And I was 37 years old when I got sober in 81. And up until that time, I know I would have passed any lie detector test on earth when I told you the really compelling, romantic, and interesting saga. It wasn't just a story, it was a saga about my early struggles and subsequent rise to power. And of course, it was all about how by my iron will and my sterling intellect, I had pulled myself up by the bootstraps from the depths of poverty to those staggering heights I'd reached in life. And I believed that crap so sincerely, I would usually have you and me both in tears before I was halfway done with it. And I wasn't sober a week when I realized, man, it was a bunch of crap. We weren't even poor. We were middle-class farming people that had everything we needed and most of the things we wanted. And those heights that I thought I'd reached were a whole lot more staggering than they were high. My alcoholism infests every fiber of my being on every level, and it's got so many different faces and heads. Sometimes I think of it as a hydra. But one thing it is something that my English, high school English teacher, Ms. Wallace, would have called a disease of superlatives. And what that means is that without divine intervention, I won't even think in terms of things like good and bad, and ordinary won't ever cross my mind. I'll think in terms of the absolute extremes, best, worst, that sort of thing. Truth is, both drunk and sober, I've always been a whole lot more just plain old garden variety than my ego's ever been able to stand. What was really going on that first 12 or 13 years of my life wasn't into that interesting romantic crap. It was the self-centeredness. The book says that selfishness and self-centeredness are the root of our troubles. And what that's meant to me for many years is that the first thing wrong with me is I've got an ego disorder. And I've had it all my life. And that's wrong with me before I had the mental obsession with alcohol, before the physical allergy became a factor, before any of the other terrible things that alcoholism brings about. As far back as I can remember, I've had that disorder of my ego. And what it does, it makes me so obsessed with myself, so obsessed with how I believe I stack up against other people, and so obsessed with how I feel. In fact, the last several years, I've tended to boil the very basis of my alcoholism down to one sentence, and for me, I think it's valid. And here's that sentence. Without divine intervention, I will always wind up letting how I feel be the most important thing in the world to me. Now, without divine intervention, I can give some lip service to something being more important than how I feel. And I might be able to act for just a little while like something might be more important. But if I haven't done the work I need to do to get my divine intervention when those chips get down, that's all a smokescreen. And I'm going to wind up letting how I feel be the most important thing in this universe. And that ego disorder is what robbed me of any teachability or humility. And the way it did that is I don't remember a single time in the first 37 years of my life that I ever voluntarily followed a suggestion that anybody made about how to run my life unless I understood it and I agreed with it and I thought it would work. That sounds pretty good right today, doesn't it? Why in the world should I do something about my life if I don't understand it or I don't agree with it or don't think it'll work? Well, when I get honest, it's real simple. I've got a talking illness and an old crazy picture show rolling in the back of my head, and they are still alive and well, and they are there, and they are stone sociopaths. They are not trying to kill me because they don't care whether I live or die. My alcoholism, and by the way, my alcoholism talking to me and my brain talking to me, if I haven't done the work I need to do today to get my divine intervention, are one and the same thing because I've got an alcoholic brain. And my alcoholism doesn't have but one reason for existing, that's try to get itself another drink. And it will tell me anything on the face of this earth to get it, something that might kill you or me or both of us. It'll tell me totally inconsistent lies back to back with one another without ever dropping a stitch. It doesn't care. Well, I've already told you that my recovery has not been that old crazy picture show has gone away. What my recovery has been is that most of the time I can recognize that that's not reality and I don't have to obey it. But the important phrase is most of the time. Now, if you've been around here a week, you have probably heard somebody say that alcoholism is a disorder of our perception. If I go to the dictionary and look up those words, here's what I come away with. What that means, folks, is I don't see things right. I don't hear them right. I don't always recognize them for what they are. So the bottom line for me is real simple. When I put the final veto power in the universe, the final say-so, in my little old brain, that I'm not going to do it unless I understand it and I agree with it and I think it will work, with what I've got wrong with me, I have just put myself under death sentence because I wind up believing one of those deadly lies. And I'll pick up that drink, and when I do, it'll trigger that phenomenon of craving and that physical allergy, and I'll make it to that pauper's grave and that mad dog death that I was dazed from in April 1981. Another thing that ego disorder's always done for me, it's what robbed me of the ability to even consider a personal God, because my ego wouldn't let me consider that there was anything more important than my brain in the actual conducting and running of my life on a minute-to-minute basis. Kind of a funny little thing it's always done to me. It's made me an egomaniac with an inferiority complex. And what I mean by that is I've always been perfectly capable of feeling too good for something or somebody, and at the same instant knowing I wasn't nearly good enough for that same thing or that same person. And the overall thing that ego disorder's always done is create so much pain and so much emptiness down inside me, not letting me be okay with anything or anybody on the face of this earth. I'd be too good for it. I can be not good enough. I can be both at the same time. But without divine intervention or something else to fill up that emptiness and do something about that pain, that obsession with myself creates, I can't stand the way I feel inside myself. So what was really going on the first 12 or 13 years of my life was trying to stay a half a step ahead of a screaming fit on account of that self-centeredness and all the pain and emptiness that followed it. I was 12, 13 years old. I got drunk first time. First night I got in a lot of trouble. I puked, blacked out, passed out, woke up the next morning, had a terrible hangover. Swore all those Baptists around there were right, and I would never, ever do it again. And not only was I sincere, it was fairly effective because it was nearly a week until I got drunk the second time. And after all those problems I had that first time I got drunk the second time for exactly the same reason that I got drunk the 2,000th time and all the times in between. When I got enough of that stuff inside me, for the first time in my life, it did something about that pain and that emptiness that that obsession with myself creates. And for the first time in my life, it made me feel good enough that I could just be still and not try to stuff anything else in there or even try to run as hard as I could so I didn't have to notice, didn't have to do any of that. For the first time in my life, it made me feel good enough inside myself that I could stand the way I felt without running or trying to stuff anything else in there. Now remember, how I feel without divine intervention is the most important thing in the universe to me. So my powerlessness over alcohol is not a bit mysterious to me. In fact, it's a no-brainer. It couldn't have been any other way. Because for the next 25 years after that first drunk, when I needed and wanted to change the way I felt, since the way I feel is the most important thing in the world, and that was the only thing I knew to change the way I felt, the bottom line was real simple. It did not matter what it cost. And it did not matter who it cost. Because how I feel is the most important thing in this universe. I'm not going to give you all a drunkalogue, but I'll tell you that I was joking with Beth and some folks at lunch when we got here on Friday that I only came here because it gave me the hiccups. I really hadn't had much problem with it, but I was already very spiritual and thought that probably I could get on even a higher spiritual plane and be of some help to you folks if you got here. And believe me, I had my tongue in cheek when I did that. From my first drunk till I got sober 25 years later, alcohol dominated everything in my life. Not just alcoholism, alcohol did. We all have different drinking stories and an oddity. One of the other speakers, don't remember whether it was Dave or Sandy, but what I mentioned, how easy it is for us to lie about how bad we are, you know, one up in one another. But the honest truth is that I never apologized for my drinking. You either accepted my drinking or you had to get out of my life. I don't remember ever one time in my life telling myself or anybody else that I was just going to have a couple of drinks. I never wanted a couple of drinks. A couple of drinks never did anything to me except make me want to drink real bad. Nobody ever had to tell me that drinking in the morning would cure a hangover. I was born knowing that in the marrow of my bones. I had the phenomenon of craving the first drink of alcohol I ever took, and it progressed over the years. The reason I did not drink around the clock had nothing to do with nobility or ambition. It was terror. It was terror that if I didn't lay in that bed and smoke one cigarette after another and let pieces of the night before come back to me and be terrified about what I wasn't ready to face that day and finally get just propelled out of the bed by that terror and go stick a toothbrush in my mouth and at least half the mornings for 25 years barf and then try to put on the right clothes and go where I was supposed to go and make the right noise. It was terror that if I didn't do that, you'd see what I was and what I wasn't, and I'd have to face it. And it'd be like the earth would swallow me up through that emptiness in my own middle, and I knew I wouldn't be able to stand that. But for that 25 years, I know I went to bed legally drunk at least 80% of the nights. Had no idea I was going to bed drunk that often, because the only standard or definition I ever had for drunk was whether or not I blacked out. If I remembered everything, that discussion was over. I was not drunk. Now that Kentucky's got that legal limit at .08, I'm sure I woke up drunk 80% of the mornings. School was really easy for me, and it was a different world in the 1950s, as those of you that are old enough to remember it. In today's world, a kid drinking and acting the way I did, they would throw a net over them and have them in an asylum before their 14th birthday. But in the 1950s in Trigg County, Kentucky, if you were cute enough, smart enough, and had the right last name, you could get away with murder. And I did get away with murder. And when I was 16 years old and a junior in high school, I was still holding on to things by my fingernails, but I was still holding on. And the realistic part of me knew it was time to get out of Dodge. that on account of my drinking, everything was about to collapse. And the egomania part of me was telling me that tobacco patch couldn't hold something as hot as I was anyway. So I walked out of a tobacco patch in August of the year of when I just finished my junior year high school. And I went out and got on a Greyhound bus and took it 200 miles up to the big city of Louisville. And I kicked around a couple of days, and I wound up on the doorstep of the University of Louisville. And they gave me several days' test and let me in as an early admission student with an academic scholarship. And my reaction to that was to stay so drunk the first semester that I lost all concept of day and night. Just a matter of passing out and coming to, and of course I blew the scholarship. So then for the next 7.5 years, I worked full-time, drank full-time, went to school full-time, and somehow got through undergraduate and law school, and I haven't got a clue how that happened. When I look back on that whole 8 years, it's just a whirling gray mass of alcoholic insanity. I don't have a handful of concrete memories of it. Spring of 1968, I graduated from law school, and my daughter, Dana, I have two blood children and three wonderful stepdaughters. My two blood children, Dana's 42, and my son is 21. But Dana was my only child for over 20 years, and she was born in that spring of 1968, and I had told Beth and some of them at the table, and I'm just so excited about this. And in September, I have been asked to go over to Moscow, Russia, and Kiev, Ukraine, and do the steps through an interpreter. And my daughter, Dana's an artist, and she studied in Russia and was married for a while to a Russian man and is involved in Al-Anon, has been for over 20 years, and she's still fluent in Russian. So Dana's going with me. So she'll be able to do the Al-Anon without an interpreter, and I'm just really looking forward to it. But at any rate, 1968, she was born, got out of law school, started practicing law, didn't plan to become a criminal defense lawyer. Alcohol dominated, made every decision in my life. Somebody said that, one of the other speakers said that this weekend, and that's so true. That's exactly what it did, made every decision in my life. Had some success, not nearly as much as I used to think I had had. It's interesting, as we stay sober longer, we get a different focus on our past. But I have always, both in the first stage of my career and later, I've always had a knack for getting involved in some things that had some money in them and had some publicity in them. And that's what I would stick in your face during the first 10 years I practiced law from 1968 to 1978. When you suggested there was something wrong with somebody who lived as insanely as I did. And I already told you how insanely I was living up to that point. It escalated when I got out of law school. It escalated because the illness progresses. It escalated because I had some money to escalate it with. During that 10 years, I used a world of things other than the booze, but just exactly like they were with Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob, everything else was a sideshow to the booze. Everything else was something to change the effect of the booze, increase the effect, decrease the effect, help me try to function on the hangovers. But the booze was the big tent. That's where it all went back to. February 10th of 1978, I got full of a whole bunch of things, primarily a blood alcohol of over 0.40 booze. I'd been practicing law for 10 years. I was remarried to my daughter's mother at the time, and over the years, by the way, in sobriety, I've decided that probably establishes my alcoholism without further authentication. And that's not because there's anything particularly wrong with my daughter's mama. I just looked around. I swear I don't believe in the history of the world anybody ever did that but us. I think if a normie even considered jumping right back in a frying pan that they just got out of, they'd tear the door off the asylum getting in to protect themselves. And we do it routinely, drunk and sober. You know, old Joe and Sue divorced, but they're dating. They'll probably get back together. And the really bizarre thing is it works for us sometimes. You know, it's not bad. It's just real different from ordinary people. But at any rate, I had a young lady with me who was not my daughter's mother, February 10th, 1978. Drove a Corvette off the road down on the Kentucky-Tennessee line at about 130 miles an hour. Did an awful lot of bad things to my body. Broke both legs, crushed both knees, lost the main myocardial artery in one lower leg. Had to do a bypass in the upper leg and take out a vein, graft it in to replace that artery. And separated my pelvis and pulled my plumbing in two, so I didn't have a urinary function for over a year. I had a suprapubic catheter, they call it, which is just a plastic tube with a flange on it where they bore that into your, put that in your bladder, you carry your urine out to a bag. And that first year I had a half dozen major surgeries was in hospital more than 6 months. The doctors told me early on that I'd never walk again without at least a brace on one leg and maybe both, and probably a cane or canes, and that they were real sure that we'd never find a surgeon anywhere that would attempt to put my plumbing back together so I would ever pee again. Just for the record, and purely by the grace of God, I've been sober 29 years, and I haven't owned a brace or a cane for over 30 years. And about a year after that wreck, right over here in Durham, North Carolina, the head of urology at Duke University put my plumbing back together and restored my urinary function. But I didn't know that was going to happen. So my reaction, they took me to Vanderbilt in Nashville to start with because I was closer to that, but after, they didn't know who I was there. They didn't treat me with nearly the appropriate deference. And as soon as I was able, I got myself moved with entourage back to Louisville. And I laid in the Louisville hospitals for months. And every single day, my friends would come in and bring me booze and more dope than the doctors were giving me. Nobody ever said one word to me. And I would lay in there. And by the way, those friends, some few of them are with me in recovery today. A couple are doing long-term, basically, life in the penitentiary. Most of them are dead. None of us are still out there doing it and haven't been for a lot of years. None of us who were living the way I did. But at any rate, these guys would bring it in to me, and I would lay in that hospital bed and say really intelligent things. I would say things like, you know, fellas, anybody can quit drinking when the going gets a little tough. But it takes a man to land there with it when the bills start coming in. So give me another drink and let's go on with it. And that is real insanity. That is true powerlessness. And when you think it through, it's the ultimate in letting how I feel. No, suicide is the ultimate, but it's way down the line in letting how I feel be the most important thing in the universe. Letting how I feel in the instant be more important than whether I walked, whether I peed, more important than my child, my profession, more important than whether I lived or died. Letting how I feel in the minute be the most important thing in this universe. I didn't go broke right away after that wreck. Of course, my daughter's mama re-divorced me, and I wound up during that period married to the young lady who was with me. She was hurt, but not as badly as I was. She had on a seat belt, for God's sake. And didn't go broke because a little law firm built up around this other guy and myself, so some money kept coming in for a while. And about a year after that wreck, I still had the tube in my belly and my catheter bag and my braces and my crutches, and I made my first trip to the asylum. And I don't use the word asylum to be cute. Bill Wilson uses that word in the Big Book, and my mama used that word. When I was a kid, people didn't have substance abuse problems and go to treatment, and they didn't have breakdowns and go to the hospital. They went crazy and got put in asylums, and that's a whole lot more descriptive of what kept happening to me. And by the time I got in that first one, the phenomenon of craving that the doctor's opinion talked about, and listen, if you know the phenomenon of craving, I don't need to describe it to you. And if you don't know it, I'm not going to waste my breath. Because the phenomenon of craving in its progressed form, the way it was in the end of my drinking, is the most powerful physical force I've ever felt in my life. And the most painful physical thing I've ever felt in my life. The total drunken sober of 12, 14 major surgeries I have don't even get in the category. Don't even get close to that phenomenon of craving. And by that time, once I got alcohol in my body, I just pretty well physically lost the ability to stop. Something had to intervene and get me prized loose from alcohol. And when it did that, it took 3 or 4 days for me to be physically able to do something like sit up in a chair. Well, they got me through the 3 or 4 days in that first asylum, set me up in a chair, and had an AA meeting, and somebody read the steps. and they got to step three and started mumbling something about God as they understood him, turning my life and will over to something like that. And of course that insulted my intelligence. So I climbed up on my crutches and straightened up my catheter bag and said as loud as I could, "Do you mean to tell me there are people in this world who believe such crap?" Then I hobbled on over the telephone, got somebody to come get me away from the religious fanatics before they polluted my pristine intellect. Well, that was sometime around the first of the year of 79. I wound up getting sober about 2.5 years later in April of 81, and I really don't remember much of that. Some things I do know happened are that I went back to the asylum 17 more times in that period. I had an awful lot of bad things happen to me. I wound up with the guys kicking me out of the law firm that I'd founded, the state of Kentucky, jerking my law license. My new wife that had married had to leave me on account of the insanity during that period. And during that period, she was staying with some girlfriends and died in an accident. I last laid eyes on my daughter, my only child, Dana, in January of 1980, and I didn't see or talk to Dana again for over 3 years. The Internal Revenue took my portion of the office building we'd built in downtown Louisville and a couple of things like that, and the mortgage companies took the homes the ex-wives were in, and it was just all gone. And for about a year up until the fall of 1980, I lived without an address on what I called the street and an expired Blue Cross Blue Shield card. And I lived every day of that with the conscious conviction that I had to die of alcoholism. Because, you see, I had a head full of information about AA and about recovery. A good half of those places I'm calling asylums had treatment programs that were based on the 12 steps. And since I didn't have anywhere to go, sometimes between trips to the asylum, I'd go to a world of meetings. So I had a head full of information about AA. In fact, it truly is one of my sincere and frequent prayers today that I don't ever know as much about AA as I did before I could get sober. And I mean that with all my heart. And what would happen during that period of time? One of you would tell me how AA had saved your life, changed your life. And my brain, my alcoholism, remember, they're one and the same thing, would go, "Yeah, I know it works for you guys. And I'm really grateful it does. You know, of course, y'all are simple-minded compared to me. And you don't understand how unique my circumstances are and how intelligent I am. And my God, I've just played on such a broad stage. And my tentacles have touched so many. And in your little simplicity, you don't understand that I see things more clearly than ordinary people. And I feel them so much more acutely that I'm wounded by my own understanding. So I'd get teary-eyed, so grateful it would work for the simple-minded. But of course, I couldn't babble about your myth of higher power and go to your little group therapy sessions you call meetings. And here was the biggest difference at all. In your simplicity, you could concentrate on the drinking and ignore what, in my case, the drinking and the things like it were just symptoms or results of the real problem. You all didn't understand. My God, my problem was so magnificent and complex that it wouldn't make any sense to just concentrate on the little drinking and that sort of thing. We had to find some way to resolve this magnificent and terrible problem, so it wouldn't work for me because of my magnificence. And here's the nightmare, or one of the nightmares. The very next minute, one of you would tell me how AA had saved your life and changed your life. And that same brain would go, "Yeah, I know it works for you guys, but you don't know how bad I am. You don't know about the parts of me that are just missing. They always have been. I've never really been able to love anything or anybody, not even myself. And you guys don't understand that anything in my life that even looks like it was okay, much less good, is some kind of pack of lies and a house of cards. And you guys have got people and things left to get sober with and to get sober for. You don't know how bad I've been. I lived in a pretty rough world as an alcoholic criminal lawyer in the early days of my life. And it really appeared to me, and by the way, I don't think it's paranoia. I think it was reasonable. I think a loving God went back and poured oil on the troubled waters of my past. But it wouldn't make any sense for me to get sober, because even if I did manage it for a couple of months, it would just be to be blowed into by a sawed-off shotgun, or at the very best, spend the rest of my life in the penitentiary. So it wouldn't work for me because I was so terrible. Very next minute, he'd be back telling me it wouldn't work for me because I was so wonderful, and I guess I was believing it both times. But fall of 1980, I washed up on the doorstep of asylum number 17 in Nashville, Tennessee. Had, of course, no home, no car, no clothes, teeth rotting out of my head. That was Cumberland Heights. They told me later, Harold Gilliland, who was involved in it there, told me later that the only reason they let me in was they did not think I would have lived a week had they left me on the street. I stayed in there about a month, had no place to go, and had a young fellow, Matt, who was my roommate, and his folks lived in Nashville, and those wonderful spiritual folks felt sorry for me and said, "Don, since you're getting, it's time for you to get out of the asylum here, why don't you come stay with us a few days and let's try to figure out what to do with you?" And I want to tell you, in fall of 1980, what to do with me was a question. And I went and lived with them a year. And the first 6 months I did not stay straight, but I got better. And I believe in my case I had to get better before I was capable of operating in sobriety. I was 2 to 3 months into my sobriety and still going down the street from the 202 Club in Nashville to the Shoney's after meetings, and using a knife and fork, having my knife and fork under the table, watching my friends use that on food. I had lost the ability to use a knife and fork on food. Wasn't a matter of forgetting, I don't guess, it was just gone. And I was just, I guess, embarrassed to turn around to my friends and say, "Excuse me, Jimmy, I seem to have lost the ability to use this knife and fork. Would you give me a few pointers?" So I believe I did need to get better. And during that 6 months from the fall of 80 until I got sober in April of 81, I did get better. Went to a world of meetings, most of them at that 202 Club in Nashville. Got to where I could go as long as 2 or 3 weeks without getting ripped. And that was a world record for me, in or out of the asylum. And how I really know I got better is they only put me back in the asylum one time in that whole six-month period. And the rate I'd been going twice a year in the asylum looked like a picture of mental health. Late March of 81, I got on my most recent drunk. It was another one of my pop-off vodka / Listerine drunks. And I have truly drunk a barrel of both those things and have better memories of the Listerine. I can stand to smell Listerine today, but I can't stand to smell old hot pop-off. But by the time April the 8th of 81 rolled around, I'd been drunk 10 days, 2 weeks, and I was sitting on the edge of a bed in a motel in Nashville. And 11 God started giving me a whole lot of gifts. Now, it's very important to me that I had no idea I had any gifts. I had no idea there was a loving God. Coming off that last drunk didn't feel any different than the 200 before it. In my case, if I had waited to see a burning bush, if I'd waited until I believed Alcoholics Anonymous could solve all my unique problems, if I'd waited until it felt like it was working, before I started blindly doing what you guys in that big book told me to do, I would have been in that pauper's grave for 29 years. I'd been given that beautiful gift of the first little teachability or humility I'd ever had in my life. 3 or 4 days after that last drunk, I stumbled back to the 202 Club. I did not think they would let me in, and they should not have let me in. A lot of things had happened in there. They'd caught me breaking the law in there. I had passed out in their AA meetings and had to be bodily carried out. They had warned the people they sponsored to stay away from me, that I was a loser and I was going to die. About 2 months before I got sober, I was walking through the 202 Club, and a big old boy who's dead now by the name of Joe Wall, Dave may remember Joe, walked up and looked down at me and said, "Don, I'm beginning to think you really are too intelligent for this program." And I thought he was giving me a compliment. My knee-jerk reaction was, "Well, thank God they have finally figured out who they're dealing with here." But he went on and he said, "And you know, that's a real shame, because we have never had anybody too dumb for this deal, and we bury you buttholes all time." And that felt like an icy hand closing over something inside me, and it was still there 2 months later when I stumbled back to the door, and they did let me in. I remember exactly what was said and who said it. They said, "Yeah, Don, come on in. You're keeping us sober." And I said, will y'all tell me one more time what I need to do if I want to live? And they said, sure, don't drink, don't take dope, go to meetings. By the grace of God, the first 60 days, I went to over 150 meetings. Now, I clearly remember that during that 60-day period, I don't think I wanted to go to a single one of them. It was still clear to me you all were religious fanatics. My brain was still assuring me that what we needed to do was get our head out of the sand, get our butt back to Louisville, get some money, get a law license, big car, good-looking woman, be somebody for heaven's sake. But I'd been given that beautiful gift that I didn't know I had, of being able to turn around to my brain and say, yeah, I know, partner, but you and I have nearly killed one another, and we don't have anything left to do but go to these dumb old meetings, even though they can't possibly solve our unique problems. And the greatest miracle is that those meetings worked just as well as if I had thought, felt, and believed they were exactly what I needed. You see, all of my life, as far back as I can remember, right up until this Sunday morning in Charlotte, North Carolina, without divine intervention, I'll make the same mistake over and over and over again about everything in my life. I will make it all about what I think, feel, and believe. I will make what I think, feel, and believe the ultimate reality of everything. Without divine intervention, if I wake up and don't feel like doing what I need to do and what's the right thing to do, in nature, it does not occur to me to do it anyway. What occurs to me is, let's get me fixed so I feel like doing right. And I'm liable to do something like call up a friend in AA. I don't feel like going to work, Billy. What can we do to fix me so I feel right and feel like going to work? Well, if you're an alcoholic of my type, I'm getting ready to give you some really depressing news. 29 years sober, I have prayed until I was blue in the face to get God to fix me inside so I would feel like doing right. I have worried sponsors to distraction about it. I bet I've done a foot and a half of inventories on it. After I got some money, I got me some outside counseling going to work on me and get me adjusted inside so I would feel like doing right. Here's the bad news. Not one time in 29 years has anything made me feel like doing right except going on and doing right when I don't feel like it. And that is almost more maturity than I can stand. So then after they told me to go to the meetings, they said, read the big book. I said, I've read it several times. They said, we know you've been quoting it to us and criticizing the literary style while you've been dying, dummy. They said, you've got in your head this is some sort of philosophy book, and there's something in here you can learn or master that's going to somehow transport you to a sublime state of sobriety. They said, you better get it turned around if you're going to live. I said, in the first place, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is not the solution to your alcoholism. And I said, wait a minute. You have been telling me for 2.5 years that the big book is the solution to my alcoholism. And they said, no, we haven't. We have been telling you that the action described in that book is the solution to your alcoholism. They said, another thing you need to get straight is this crap about recovery being a learning process. They said, you got to learn about that much. And they said, in your case, Don, you have had enough information about recovery for over 2 years to stay sober a day at a time the rest of your life. They said, what's killing you is not what you know and don't know, dummy. It's what you're doing and not doing. And what recovery is, instead of a learning process, is a doing process. They said, there's nothing psychological about it. There's nothing intellectual about it. And if you try to make it in any form a psychological or an intellectual process or a process based on merit, it won't work any better than all the other psychological, intellectual, and merit-based things through the millennia have worked on alcoholism. They said, this is a spiritual deal, and it's based on grace. And it's based on you coming like a little child was going to do a follow-the-dots picture and having no idea what the picture would emerge. But the child would be willing, I'll draw this line from this dot to this dot to this dot to this dot, following the directions, especially when I don't agree with them, especially when I think they won't work. Because, you see, when I did that, when I was given the gift of being able to start doing what other folks told me, a lot of miracles happened. And one was my life was out of the control of a lunatic. Turning it over to anything or anybody would have been better than what I had, because all I know to do is kill me. And by the way, I'm going to wind up just a minute, but something I just wanted to say this morning. You know, we say many times that I am the problem, and I understand that. I understand why folks say I am the problem, and I can say I am the problem, but that's dangerous for me. Because when I become the problem, there is nobody on earth that will ever know any tiny fraction of as much about Don Major as I know about me. When the unique person Don Major is the problem here, you guys can't help me. I proved God knows that the medical and psychiatric professions cannot help me. I'm in trouble. I'm up the creek without a paddle if I'm the problem, because I'm the world's greatest expert on me, and all I know how to do with me is kill me. But on the other hand, when my problem is alcoholism instead of the unique problem of me, I've got 1,000 teachers. I've got all you folks with our common problem. And we have got our common solution. And you can take me by the hand and lead me through the solution. And you know, my insane ideas come to me right today. And I've never had a single one come up and say, "Good morning, Don, I'm a crazy idea and I'm here to kill you." They always come up and say, "Hi, buddy, I'm common sense. You know, let's talk about this." And I've learned that my insane ideas don't ever sound like common sense to you, and yours don't ever sound like common sense to me. You know, if we'll just get it out there and share it with one another, it'll work. So they explained to me about going through that big book that I better come back to it like a little child and try to act like I'd never read it before. Start at the front cover and go through it line for line, reading only the black part. Not interpreting, memorizing, or arguing with a darn thing. Not looking for anything to learn but for what it said do. They told me to get a sponsor. I went to 5 days sober to Cherry Carpenter. Didn't like Cherry. Cherry did not like me. I asked him to be my sponsor. Cherry said yes. Cherry and I never did get real wild about one another. He remained my sponsor until he died. I never rode in a car with him. Never shared a meal with him. He never called me one time except to return my call. But Cherry Carpenter, with the possible exception, my father is the most important man in my life, because he was willing to be what a sponsor is. You know, Cherry had some really good ideas. For instance, Cherry believed that there was way too much emphasis on talking to one sponsor. He thought the emphasis ought to be on listening to one sponsor. Cherry let me know real early that nobody ever talked themselves well. But at any rate, there was, and that's when they explained to me that the steps are the only program of recovery. I can grab hold of the fellowship and then be a member of the fellowship on any day I've got a desire to stop drinking, no other requirement. But if I grab hold of it that way without doing the steps, I might stay dry a week, or I might stay dry 30 years. But if I do it that way, I'll have no healing of what's really wrong. That disordered ego, that inability to be comfortable inside myself. That healing only comes from those 12 steps, doing them the way the book says do them. And by the way, speaking at conferences is great, and all the hoop-de-rah and the tapes, it's all great. But where AA is for me is that new guy, or whether they're new or not, anybody that asks me to work with me, asks me to be their sponsor, say, "Hey, let's go through the steps together." And where Alcoholics Anonymous lives to me is sitting in a room by myself or with another alcoholic, just the two of us. And we are going through those steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's where it lives. And that's all I've got to share with you folks today. Then they told me if I wanted to live, they'd already told me don't drink, don't take, don't go to meetings and read the big book and explain to me about the steps. Then they told me I was going to have to get on my knees every morning and every night. And tears came to my eyes. I said, "I can't do that. The second step is what's killing me. I've been trying for 2.5 years to change what I think, feel, and believe. Can't change a thing." Finally heard them when they said, "Don, you've got that backwards too. We would never suggest that you think, feel, or believe anything." They said, "In the first place, you're too sick to have any valid thoughts, feelings, or beliefs." Said, "In the second place, the issue of whether you live or die will be determined solely by what you do. What you think, feel, or believe won't have a thing to do with it." So if you want to live, you get down on your knees, start saying those words morning and night. Don't worry about what's going through your old mind, because it won't count. having no idea why I was doing it, embarrassed, 100% acting as if. Sometime in April of 81, I started getting down there every morning and every night, saying words I did not believe to something I did not believe was there. And the miracle of the second step began to happen. And as far as I know, I haven't missed a morning or night getting on my knees since April of 81. But I'm not telling you that to tell you how great I am. I'm telling you that because I've gotten down there all those thousands of mornings and nights, and there's been a bunch of times when I hadn't felt like it and could have gotten a written medical excuse. Been a whole lot of times, and probably half time, I hadn't really wanted to get down there. Now, it still happens that sometimes I wake up with my brain spinning and I feel cut off from you and cut off from God. I get down there and try to pray, and sometimes I have to think to remember the last word I just tried to pray. Brain scattered. It's obvious to me the words are bouncing off the wall and ceiling. Couldn't possibly be doing any good. But I'm getting down there every morning, every night. Something's worked every single day. You see, prayer, like the rest of our program, recovery, is not a psychological process. It's not based on merit. God is not suffering from lack of information about my needs unless I specifically delineate them. And I certainly am not going to state it so eloquently that I'm going to sway God. The only thing valuable about my prayer is my willingness to humble myself before my Creator and say, please. And thank you. And please give me knowledge of your will. Please let me try to quit figuring out the pattern, which I can never do. See, without divine intervention in every area of my life, I want to figure out the pattern so I'll know where to start stitching. I'm 66 and hadn't figured out a single pattern right yet. When I'm trying to figure out the patterns of my life, I'm in worse shape than a chimpanzee trying to master quantum physics. I just can't do it. My job is stitching. And there's a little spark of the divine inside me, and I believe every one of us, that knows God's will only in the right now. Never for 5 seconds from now, much less tomorrow or 5 years from now. But when I will listen and just take that stitch, even though my old brain is scared and says, man, this pattern's not going to work out to suit me. But if I'll just listen, God will give me my guidance in the moment, and like a little child. I've been stumbling that way. I've always sober, gone to 4 or 5 meetings a year, 21 months sober, or 4 or 5 meetings a year, a week. That'd be a good one. They led me through the steps, first 9 steps in Nashville, began to teach me how to live on 10, 11, and 12. 21 months sober as a byproduct of steps 8 and 9. My law license has been put back in order. I went back to Louisville, went back in my law practice, scared to death. The second month I was in Louisville, by God incidents, I talked at the Kentucky State Conference in front of 2,000 people because the speaker got snowed in. People started saying nice things. Will you talk here? Will you be my sponsor? Will you do this? That same month, I saw my daughter Dana for the first time in over 2 years. 2 months later, Dana moved in with me and lived with me all through her high school years. And she and I remain dear friends today. First 9 years of my sobriety were great. I began speaking around the country, sponsoring loads of people here and there, and it was great. Started making some money practicing law again and driving a decent car, wearing decent clothes. And it was the fourth dimension of existence, except relationships with the opposite sex and financial chaos like to have killed me. When I was 9 years sober, something happened, and I began to look at steps 6 and 7 a different way. And I came back to my God and realized 6 and 7 wasn't where I went to work on me with God's help. And it certainly wasn't where I prayed for God to take away what I wanted gone because it was making me uncomfortable. I know now I might as well have been praying for a Ferrari as be praying for a character defect to be gone because I want it gone. Because, see, I don't know what God's doing to fit me to be of maximum service to God and those around me. I have no idea what God's doing. My problem with perfection is not my inability to attain it. I certainly am unable to attain it. But that's never mattered. My problem with perfection is my inability to recognize it. And for the last 20 years, I've been stumbling in that direction of just trying to stumble and take that next stitch and not pay that much attention to the pattern. I've done it so poorly and had to start over so many times, sometimes 50 to 100 times a day, that I don't think there's been a single day in the last 20 years that if you'd asked me, Don, are you doing this 6 and 7 thing well enough that it'll do any good, that I'd said, yeah, I think I nailed it today. But I want to tell you the result. If I had made a list when I was 9 years sober of everything that I thought was the best that I could have in my life. And God had said, Don, I'm sick of your whining. I'm giving you exactly what you have ordered. I would have shortchanged myself in every single area of my life. And I mean that. Sharon and I will celebrate 20 years of marriage in December. We have a wonderful, wonderful relationship and friendship. We don't argue, by the way. I sponsor some guys who are counselors and psychologists, and they tell me it's not healthy to have a relationship where you don't argue. And I tell them they're welcome to their healthy relationships. I'm just going to wallow in my illness, thank you. I'm doing just fine. The banks that wouldn't let me have a checking account when I got back to Louisville have given me unsecured lines of credit that not only are embarrassing, they're extremely unwise on their part. The Bar Association that the forgiveness, by the way, and one of the points I'm making here. Number one, you can't get humanly from where I was in 1981 to where God has brought me today. It cannot happen. It will not happen. The other thing that I really want to impress for you folks is the forgiveness of non-alcoholics. When we finally start trying to do the right thing, passes all understanding. And you've heard that in all of our talks this weekend about the forgiveness of non-alcoholics for us when we finally try to do that right thing. That bar association that I so disgraced, and it was loud, it was front page news. I never thought I'd get a law license back. They have honored me until it's embarrassing. They've made me pro bono lawyer of the year. They've made me chair of a committee that interviews people that want to be judges, decide whether they're going to be judges. And then probably the funniest thing at all, 4 or 5 years ago, I was sitting in the barber chair and my cell phone rang. It was the president of the state bar and said, Don, we've got an opening on the ethics committee. God truly has a sense of humor. The first 10 years I practiced, the only people on earth I was more afraid of than the state bar ethics committee were the IRS and the FBI. I love you all. I want to close with just one last thought. I've got an illness that is selfishness and self-centeredness, and I cannot effectively treat it by obsessing on myself. Even if I dress that obsession up in psychological or even spiritual clothing, I can't do it. I've got to do what Chuck Chamberlain did and what Chuck talked about. I've got to quit worrying about me, quit worrying about fixing me and how I feel, and start trying to help you. Start trying a step at a time to help God's kids know what they need to have fun for free and for fun because I want to. You see, if any part of me is trying to get you to love, comfort, and understand me, any part of me, if I'm motivated in any way by that, it's an absolute spiritual law that I will not be loved, comforted, and understood to my satisfaction. If you do exactly what I thought I wanted you to do, I'll change it before you're done. If I put that responsibility on you, it can't happen. The only time it's possible for me to feel loved, comforted, and understood to my satisfaction is when I'm praying that prayer of St. Francis, which I count as an 11th step prayer because it's in the 12 and 12 about the 11th step. When I'm praying, Thy will be done, I'm no longer running short. And by the way, I've always been pretty good at the 2% of the 11th step of the morning and night. It's the other 98% where I fall down. That's going through every minute of every day. Thy will be done. I'm no longer running the show. Lord, please let me seek to love, comfort, and understand rather than to be loved, comforted, and understood. And when I prayed that enough, and when I can really try to not be concerned with whether I get... And by the way, love, comfort, and understand includes things like respect and my rights and all those different things. And when I lay aside whether I'm getting any of that, and I'm trying to love, comfort, and understand you, I wind up loved, comforted, and understood beyond my wildest dreams. The exact same paradox. If I ask myself the question, what am I getting out of this about anything under the sun, and concentrate on it for about 30 seconds, the answer is not enough. So it's just the wrong question. The right question is, what can I bring to this? And when I come with that question, I wind up getting more out of it than I ever possibly could. You new folks keep coming back, and you wonderful North Carolinians and A.A. Davis writes, you got a great thing going, and I love you all. Thank you.